Hello, welcome to Pull to Open, an ongoing quest to watch all of Doctor Who in random order. I'm Chris Taylor.
And I'm Pete Paschal, and we're a couple of guys who really love the show, even if it's sometimes hard to tell.
I think it's easy to tell.
That's easy to tell.
It's good. We had an easy week this week with the show that the randomizer picked for us.
I know, so fresh. It kept us in the modern era.
It did, and the randomizer so far, this is our fourth use of the randomizer, and it loves Doctor's name Peter.
Clearly, it's, yes.
That's all we've had so far, is Davison and Capaldi episodes. It doesn't want to get out of those.
Well, it knows, it clearly knows who's one of the hosts of this show. yeah, interesting. Actually,
and there are
that,
interesting.
It's all Peter.
There are
all
interesting
the time
connections here between the two. I think each week we try to figure out why did the randomizer bring us here, and with this choice, I didn't think there would be a lot of reasons, but I've actually discovered some.
Do tell.
So let's get into it. We are in season 9, episode. I forget which episode it is.
Season 9, episode 9.
Sleep No More.
Sleep No More.
We didn't think there would be a lot of connection to the last episode, which is also Peter Capaldi episode, Dark Water / Death in Heaven.
It's leapt us forward in time a little bit, because that was the end of Series 8. Now we're in Series 9. In Series 9, it's helpful to sort of chat a little bit about it, because it was like the second series of Capaldi, and also Jenna Coleman stuck around. And they certainly revamped Capaldi a bit. Well, more than a bit, I would argue.
Oh, yeah. He became Disco Doctor. Doctor
Disco.
Yeah,
his wardrobe changed. His manner and sort of attitude wasn't entirely different, but it wasn't, they dropped some of the sort of alien coldness.
Yes. And his voice gets slightly less Scottish. I noticed this as a keen noticer of British accents. He goes slightly more Tom Bakery,
interesting,
in this season, and drops the sort of Malcolm Tucker angry Scottish bit to a certain extent. It's still there, but it's softened. And he's got the Sonic sunglasses. Yeah,
well, that's
which are
one
very
of the big things. The Sonic sunglasses, which we could maybe talk about in the recap a bit, but I mean that was an interesting choice, because I feel like the Sonic sunglasses were a bit of a one-off gag, it seemed like, for the climax of the season premiere. And then they sort of stuck with them for the rest of the season. And I know that Doctor Who I wouldn't even say it split Doctor Who fandom. I would say it was not popular with Doctor Who fandom.
And I remember you wrote a whole thing about it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's funny. Like, people might know one of my day jobs, and certainly my day job at the time, was being a technology editor. And, you know, I'm supposed to like wearable technology, right?
Yeah.
And I probably do more than most.
It was the era of Google Glass still,
exactly.
Right? People were still wearing those, so it seemed appropriate for the Doctor to wear it. But maybe that's why people didn't like it. It was a bit too buzzy. It was a bit too off the moment, too on the nose. That was
an
issue.
Well, it's also like something as built into the show as the Sonic Screwdriver at this point, which has been since, what was it, Fury from the Deep, I believe. So it is really like one of these, this mainstay. It's like, to use an analogy, perhaps like changing Spider-Man's costume.
Although the Sonic Screwdriver does take long vacations in Doctor Who history. Sure. Let's be clear about that.
It does.
But so season 9, the big hook throughout it is the hybrid. I feel like you can identify all Moffat's seasons by what's the arc, what's the hook. He's always got to have one. And in this season, it's like, who or what is the hybrid that's supposed to destroy Gallifrey? He's basically lifted the whole thing from the Star Wars prequels, like the prophecy of the Chosen One. Who's the Chosen One? Like, you know, the hybrid very much has that vibe.
Yeah, and I gotta say, until you said it just now, I kind of forgot. I mean, not that I forgot, but I was like, oh yeah, like there's so much notable about this season in this episode in the season. And one, it has nothing to do with that, but also like, oh yeah, yes, like that was such an unmemorable kind of like arc, I think, that I it's not like I was, you know, chomping at the bit during this episode to get back to it.
Well, so this is what I love about the randomizer and the setup that we've got, is that it takes us to the shows that we wouldn't necessarily rewatch, right? Because this is Sleep No More, this is episode 9, and we're 2 episodes away from one of the greatest episodes of Doctor Who, Heaven Sent. You know, that's fast. I mean, certainly my favorite of the Capaldi era, you know, sort of jockeying with Last Christmas. And I think, you know, next time we get a big Doctor Who magazine poll, it'll probably rank in the top 10. It is a fantastic episode. And yet here we are 2 episodes earlier, you know, looking at an episode that didn't get a lot of love. And the same thing happened with the early randomizer, right? We could have gone to Caves of Androzani. No, we went to Planet of Fire, right? So we're the Doctor Who podcast that touches the hearts other podcasts can't reach.
Yeah, we're backing into the epics.
but Pete, I figured out why it is the randomizer took us here. Took me some time.
Tell me, it's been racking
it's
my brain.
It's not
what is
just... It was a 2-part thing. You might say it's a hybrid.
Okay. Ironic, because this is the only episode of the season that is in 2 parts, but go on.
Yes, and doesn't mention the hybrid. But first of all, there's a lot of Peter Davidson connection in this episode that's sort of hidden, and we'll get there. You know, a little hook for the rest of the episode, fans. But also, I believe this is one of the few, if not the only, Doctor Who episode that both you and I specifically wrote about on Mashable.
Oh, that's true. I believe, yes, that's true.
I didn't realize that I did a recap and review of every single story of this season. And
I remember that.
You were at the New York Sleep No More premiere.
Right, so it's funny, because I remember when Peter Capaldi took over from Matt Smith, and we were kind of, in the American press, we were kind of spoiled by Matt Smith a bit, because he loved the U.S., he obviously had an affinity for it, he also loved New York, and he paid a visit here several times to promote the show, but he actually just genuinely loved coming here. Capaldi did not. To my knowledge, Capaldi only came to New York anyway. I know he did Comic-Con probably at least once or twice, but he only came to New York once at the for his premiere. So there were only a couple of New York-based like events, you know, that the BBC sort of took part in for press, and this was one of them. So Mark Gatiss, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Gatiss.
Yes.
Mark Gatiss, the writer of this episode, and certainly one of the more prominent behind-the-scenes people in the New Who, he came to, I believe it was the Museum of Moving Image in Queens, and sat down with a bunch of fans in the theater they have there to screen Sleep No More and talk about it. And it was an interesting time. So I checked that out. And he had lots to say, including a little bit about the sonic sunglasses, I remember, since we've just talked about it. And he strongly alluded to them going away at the end of the season. Because I remember that one of the questions was, what is it with the sonic sunglasses? It's like, hey, you know, you're something, it's fun, it's interesting. But you know the show, right? Some things come in and sometimes they come back.
he's such an affable guy.
Yeah,
I like to think that he's that way in interviews. I've not interviewed him myself. I did interview Moffat and Capaldi for season 9 at San Diego Comic-Con.
Nice.
Obviously, we didn't specifically discuss this episode, but I remember Moffat being very irritable when I talked about Gallifrey. Obviously, he didn't want to reveal that it was coming back.
Stephen Moffat has never not been irritable in an interview. He is one of these people who really, he barely tolerates the press. Honestly, he barely tolerates the fans.
Yes.
Every time I've seen him speak.
I'm Scottish. I can complain about things. Yes.
Yeah.
That is very much him.
It's his thing. But yeah, so anyway, I digress a bit on the Gatiss appearance. I'll have more to say about what he had to say. But yeah, we both wrote about this for Mashable. I did sort of a bit of an overview / quotes from his Q&A. And you did a whole recap and review.
I did. And I think it's fair to say you liked it better. I think, which is maybe partly a function of seeing it on the big screen. That was sort of the first thing that I thought when I started watching it was, I bet this looked amazing on a big screen, and I can see how it sort of had less of an impact on a small one. But I gave it my lowest grade of the season, unfortunately. C-.
C-. Wow, ouch. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. So now we kind of know where we stood back in 2015. Let's see where we land on this this second viewing. Because the
randomizer has taken us perhaps to a scene of our biggest conflict over Doctor Who in terms of disagreement over an episode.
It's the randomizer clearly knows we need to resolve this before we can go any further. So should we hit play? Should we start with the recap?
I wanted to see, because Dark Water, Death in Heaven, rewatching that sort of made me at peace with it for a while. Like I realized I'd had some long running issues with how dark it got, the whole don't cremate me thing that we talked about last week. And I liked it so much better this time, and I enjoyed it so much more. And I was hoping, I just hope that maybe the same thing could happen with Sleep With Me. I'm going to spoil it now and say that it did not.
Wow, okay, guys.
And I had all of the issues that I had the first time around, I'm afraid I had the second time around. So, but let's get into it.
Interesting, yeah. So I'll save mine, just so we have some secret till the end, I'll save my revised assessment of this till the end. But it starts out, I mean, like, it's unusual for many reasons, this episode, and one is that there's no title sequence. Now, it starts out still with the cold open with this this person, Dr. Rasmussen, and he is talking about how he's trying to make sense of something that just happened, and that he has apparently a lot of footage that of what had just happened to him in some place in space, and he's going to show it to us, even though we should not watch. So, you know, this is very smart, promising opening, I'll have to say, because it is unusual. It really piques your interest, probably more so because for the lack of title sequence, which is obviously clearly they're going all the way with this found footage idea. But the found footage thing, you know, they hadn't done it before, really, in the series, to my knowledge. So certainly not to the scale. So it is, you know, you're like, okay, this is going to be an interesting ride. This is going to be fun.
And it's Rhys Shearsmith, who's you know, sort of modern British acting royalty, was in The League of Gentlemen with Mark Gatiss, and he was also a doctor, very briefly.
A doctor.
Yes, he was two years before this. He was in An Adventure in Space and Time.
Oh, of course. Yes.
In which he plays very briefly Troughton, Patrick Troughton, coming in to replace William Hartnell. I don't think he even has a speaking role in that, but it's an interesting quirk that here we are with a cold open in a show with no title sequence, and a guy who has played the Doctor is here playing something else. So another reason why this episode is unique.
Yeah, it's interesting. I got to say, it's almost like I would love to see a multi-doctor episode where they bring in like everyone who was never an official doctor. So you get like, you know, David Bradley and
Rhys Shearsmith.
Yeah, and then even God, why is his name escaping me now? He voices the Daleks.
Nicholas Briggs.
Nicholas Briggs, because he was kind of the doctor in the comic. It's a long story. There's a comic strip where someone's drawn exactly like him. I'm sure he's had like other stints sort of being the doctor in various other unofficial media, but you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Big Finish has a lot of unofficial doctors.
Right. And Richard E. Grant.
Yes. Everyone in The Curse of Fatal Death, including Joanna Lumley.
There's probably more of these than officials, really, if you think about it. you'd have to get some kind of criteria on who's the right doctor, like what qualifies you as sort of an unofficial doctor. You know, you can't just be in some fan film.
The most recent guy that was added was, you know, they reshot some scenes for Legopolis on the Blu-ray, I believe, and so they had an extra scene of the Doctor hanging from the radio tower, and they drafted in some student to play to play Tom Baker at that moment.
Yeah, that guy doesn't count.
I just love the line in Doctor Who magazine was like, "Everyone, update your spreadsheets." It's like, oh god, yes, we are such nerds that we would have spreadsheets of everyone who's ever played the Doctor.
Indeed.
So anyway, Ree Sheersmith chewing the scenery a little, doing that sort of, you know, it's kind of a sci-fi trope, you know, breathless guy in a space station that appears to be in some sort of danger.
Yeah, and also the trope of, like, you know, we don't have the main characters finding this footage, but there's always like, hey, check the logs of what happened at this horrible, horrible place. And this is sort of like what we're taught to expect. So there's this intro, and then when basically we cut to sort of your standard four military personnel getting ready to mount some kind of rescue. And I think in your recap, you said these guys are like, it's kind of a trope. They're almost from Central Casting. You know, they're all kind of quirky and different in their own ways. There's a grunt who's actually called a grunt.
Literally called a grunt.
Yeah.
And you know he's a clone because he's got the strange markings on his face. Because why wouldn't you do that with clones?
Yeah, I felt like this scene had like a little too much like background exposition coming at me. Like I got what they were right away, but it, you know, they were on a ship and they're going to the space station to rescue people. But I also felt like there wasn't quite. I was getting a little bit of Terminus vibes almost, and I felt like there wasn't enough sort of difference in how the ship looked versus the space station, and I was always a little bit confused as to which was where. And I don't know. I felt like it was a little. They could have oriented you a little better, but maybe that was the point, that you're a little disoriented. But I was sort of almost like, where are they? I was kind of wondering.
The main problem with this group is we're not given any reason to care about any of them. They're not really given distinct personalities. You know, you have the sort of tense, anxious one, who's called a Rip for reasons that will become clear later. You know, and the only distinguishing feature of the leader of this crew, even though she's rather special in Doctor Who history, it's the first openly transgender actor to appear in Doctor Who, Bethany Black, and they've just sort of they've given her, and this is the only thing only a British viewer would notice, a Geordie accent.
Oh wow.
Which is a little weird because she's from Lancashire, which is not Geordie, which is not the northeast of England, is the accent from that region is known as Geordie. That's where I grew up.
Oh wow!
It's an accent I do not have, by the way.
Right, I was thinking.
Yeah.
In case you were wondering, guys.
I was kind of bullied at school for not having that accent, so it's always a little weird to hear it.
Oh man, sorry to hear that.
But she, you know that she's Geordie because she keeps saying pet. She keeps calling everyone pet, which is a very Geordie thing. But she hasn't quite nailed the accent. It's a very difficult British accent to get. If you know the movie Billy Elliot, that's sort of its most prominent appearance in media. She doesn't quite nail it here. But so maybe that was a little distracting. But yeah, Mark Gatiss is not expert at crafting new characters that are sort of instantly memorable with a line or two, unfortunately.
True. And I feel like he's a little in love with his own writing in that it's almost like you're trying to intrigue us and make us think back to this scene or even watch it again to sort of pick out the things that we didn't understand the first time. Mm. But that puts a lot of faith in us wanting to go back and do that.
Also, his quirk here, his future quirk, is that there's been a catastrophe and India and Japan are somehow close together, so there's lots of Indo-Japanese culture.
Right. Yeah, and apparently that was because he'd recently taken a trip there, which is fine. I mean, that's, you know, writers write what they know and what's on their mind, so, but there's otherwise really no reason for it.
It was also, apparently, he talks about the great catastrophe that caused this to happen, and he said in interviews he was referring to Frontios,
right? Which is like, are you a fan or not? Like, I mean, first of all, that's not what they say happens in Frontios, which the Earth was supposedly doomed and crashing into the sun. And I don't know, to nerd out, let's do a little nerd digression here, like yeah. get really into the weeds. Like, to be, fans have pretty much settled that the catastrophe of Frontios is, you know, billions of years in the future and coincides with either the end of the Earth or is part of when, well, what was it, the Ark from the first Doctor era, when basically it matches sort of the end of the Earth, which is like, okay, that didn't happen. At least that didn't happen in the 38th century, according to Doctor Who. But, I mean, yeah. What I did like about this, and it, I don't think it really works entirely, is that, but I like about it, I still like it, is that it's in the solar system. It's actually, we're orbiting Neptune here, which is kind of unusual. You don't usually...
Neptune doesn't get a lot of love.
Right, yeah. Like, it's either, like, Jupiter, if you're going further out. Yeah, you don't really see Neptune a lot. Neptune, you know, it's a nice color. It's a nice shade of blue. See more
it
of
doesn't
it.
Really doesn't really get any love here. It's like there's no reason for it to be set around Neptune. It's just,
yeah, well,
know.
That's the problem. It's kind of like, it's a little, gives you a little more familiarity. Oh, this is close to Earth. Awesome. This is our neighborhood. But when you get into the far future and you're like, we're in the Earth neighborhood, you kind of get the Star Trek problem where it's like, why aren't there ships just everywhere? You know, why isn't this like the busiest place? Because you're talking like this is the 38th century. Like, there's, you know,
we're
a spacefaring race. We've colonized the galaxy. Like, there should be virtually no danger here, in other words, right? Like,
yeah, you shouldn't just need to send a 4-person crew in to deal with this mysteriously empty space station. Like, you know,
right. And they make
send an entire police force in.
They make kind of the joke later that it's budget cuts. Which is funny, but it also, like, it doesn't really make sense. But
so that's the first Peter Davison connection, is that this is supposedly connected to Frontios.
Yeah.
You so know, it's a little.
They have the group here, and they get to the space station, and I think despite sort of some not great characters and a little too fast exposition, I think the story like finds its footing again pretty quickly when they meet the Doctor and Clara, and
yes.
It's mostly because of the Doctor and Clara and a lot of great dialogue. I was really laughing again about the exchange about putting space in front of things, and the Doctor saying people don't do that, they don't put, like, you know, space yogurt and space meals or whatever, or space restaurant, that's not a thing. And then she's like, well, what about space suit?
And yes, like, okay, and then later on, what about space pirates, which I thought was an excellent comeback, given that Doctor Who has had many space pirates.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, you kind of do sometimes need to put space in front of things, just to clarify. So that's pretty good. So there's a lot of witty dialogue. I really liked when they asked the Doctor, you know, what happened? He's like, oh, since the beginning of time? That's a very long story.
And, typical Doctor, yeah. Typical.
So they start to look around, and clearly, you know, they're intercut a little bit by Rasmussen, you know, be the narrator, talking about how, I think he sort of says something darkly, like, everyone, there's no crew left, right, for them to find.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do find some beans, but those turn out to be the monster of the week. And we're not sure what they are at this point, but they're these kind of big, stomping, blobby people. They actually, when I first saw them, you know what I thought? I thought the plasmatons. You know?
I thought they were the plasmatons, but
they reminded me of the plasmatons from Time Flight.
Who are the plasmatons?
The plasmatons, okay, so Time Flight in the Peter Davison era famously...
Right.
Was famously like under budget, or sorry, famously like the season went over budget, so they had no money to make Time Flight, and so they basically put people in gray tights, gray bodysuits, and filled them with, like, you know, I don't know, styrofoam or something, so they looked a little blobby, and that was like this strange thing the Master could conjure to sort of imprison people. It looked so bad.
I'm looking at pictures now. This is awesome. I think it should have been the plasmatons. I think they look amazing. They look so much better. It's interesting that you say this, because my first thought on seeing the monster again was like, oh god, this is so classic series. This is so no budget monster.
Right. That's the thing. I mean, what's disappointing? I mean, you can do stuff with low budget. I mean, the old series did it all the time, but
yeah.
It was. they're so formless, and you know you don't really get a sense of the why they're menacing. You know, they have these sort of big droopy mouths, but they don't really move. You never quite see, even through the whole episode, exactly what they do to people. You know, not that I'm looking for gore. It's Doctor Who. Mm. That doesn't happen. But
we see that they turn into dust. Like when they escape from them, the door closes and it closes on one of their arms. They turn into dust. That's the only interesting thing.
Yeah. So you sort of get the sense they're these composite beings that can somehow form themselves. And I think that ends up being true. And that's kind of interesting. But they never quite, I don't know, they're never quite menacing. And the weirdest thing, and I think you mentioned this in your review, was that, like, does anyone ever shoot them? Like we've got soldiers here with guns, and it seems like they're never actually, they never actually use the guns definitively against these monsters. And it's completely fine. And Doctor Who does it all the time to have monsters that are bulletproof in some way. And that's, I guess, what these are. But they don't do the requisite shoot the monster, show it doesn't work, and then everyone sort of, it dawns on everyone that weapons are useless.
Yeah, so all the soldiers are wearing helmets with little lights on them, and we're sort of meant to think that the found footage is coming from cameras next to those lights, right?
Right.
And we later find out, spoiler alert, that they're not actually carrying any cameras, and the found footage is something else. But it's sort of, you know, so they're carrying helmets that are sort of faking this out on having cameras, and maybe they're carrying fake guns as well. You just get that feel like, what are you even doing? Why are you even armed?
Yeah, it's like, what, there's just so much, you know there's twists, you know there's like misleads, that something's wrong here. And it is, like, this is why I think the story still kind of works, right? Because it does, the pacing was very good in that as you sort of start to realize this is a found footage, where the cameras are, you also, like, other spider sense starts going up in your brain, thinking, oh, that can't be it, or there must be something else here, or there's you know, I now, once I feel like I'm ahead of the story, I must be behind. And it actually works decently in that sense, you know, like, now that's not to say all the twists and mislead make sense, but it's structured well for what it's trying to do.
It is, you know, sort of a classic Doctor Who structure of slowly revealing the nature of the monster, making the monsters the mystery. And we don't find out until they get to the sleep pods after escaping a bunch of monsters. And here's where I sort of, you know, so I watch this late at night. You know, Pete, and listeners should know that I'm very much night owl and get much of my Doctor Who viewing done late at night. So, you know, I look forward to an episode called Sleep No More as a little nighttime horror.
Sure.
Gotta say, I started to feel sleepy around this point.
You mean so
which is not, usual. Like, I maybe blinked and missed the fact that they got connected from one of their group, Deep Ando.
He runs in some other direction.
Yeah, so I sort of blinked and missed what happened there. And there are a few times where I was sort of, like, unusually zoning out during the story. And that was one of them. Like, oh, wait, they're separated, but they've still got the grunt with them, even though the grunt was strangling someone a second ago. And it just, they're kind of ignoring that now. So the story started to unravel for me at this point. But I gotta say that once they're in the room with the sleep pods, which is what happens next, and they start to explain the sleep pods, I was back into it. I was hooked again.
Well, yeah,
it is a great concept.
It's not bad because like I said, it's paced well. They get away from the monsters. They get inside. There's investigation. There's a bit of a scare when Clara gets pulled into one of these sort of sarcophagus-like machines, these Morpheus machines, as they find out. And then I love this. I really like this device in horror movies, right? So, like, when she's in there, like, they play Mr. Sandman, right?
Yes.
The classic tune.
Well, they play the opening notes of Mr. Sandman, and the opening notes are repeated throughout, and a few lines of lyrics are repeated throughout. They never get further than, like, the first line. And you've got to wonder, like, did they just not get the rights to Mr. Sandman? Are there still rights? I don't know what the story was, but it definitely has that cheap BBC feeling.
I took that to mean that a little bit of a obvious sort of hidden meaning, given what Rasmussen does at the end. You know, it's like, Mr. Sandman, send me a dream, right? Mm. And I thought that was kind of like the, oh, it's kind of right there. I mean, sort of. In the lyric, what the plot is.
They could have made that more explicit. I think that would have been nice.
Right.
But also, at this point, if you're a nerd, you're hearing Morpheus Machine, Sandman, and Clara names the monsters the Sandman, which the Doctor objects to because he wants to be the one to name the monsters, which I thought was their best bit of dialogue in the whole thing.
And yeah, like, at this point, you're checking to see if Mark Gatiss is an anagram for Neil Gaiman.
But yeah, you as a nerd, you're watching this like, how can you not just sort of openly reference the Sandman at this point? It's so predominant in nerd culture that when you bring up the names Morpheus and Sandman in the same show, you cannot not tip the hat. Come on.
Yeah, but definitely a missed opportunity.
Especially since the guy wrote for the show twice. Know, right? And this is the thanks you give him.
It's like, you should be obligated.
Yeah.
But I am a sucker for the sort of horror movie device of the upbeat, almost silly
musical
tune
motif
that is played to in contrast to what's actually happening, the horror that's there. That's like,
it's like a music box. There's a common horror movie trope of like a music box goes off at the wrong time, and that sort of slightly too upbeat tinny sound.
Yeah, and then
is exactly what
you
they're
start
going
to
for
associate
here.
The fun, happy time sound with horror as the more they use it, which is, it's such a sort of such an easy, but I find very affecting sort of, mind game that horror movies play. I just fall for it every time.
Yeah.
So Clara gets pulled into
the
one
reveal,
of
the, right?
Yeah. Well, we get the reveal of the villain. Oh, no, I shouldn't say that. Oh, I just spoiled it.
Dope.
In case you haven't seen it.
Sorry, fans. Yeah.
So Claire is pulled into one of these things that get her out, and then we realize what they are. These are the sleep pods that will turn essentially an entire month's worth of sleep into 5 minutes, or it's basically you do 5 minutes a day in this thing and you don't have to sleep for a month. I think that was it. I forgot exactly.
Yes, which we learn from a giant floating head which appears over the product to explain the product, because this will happen by the 38th century. We'll have giant floating heads above everything. The future
wait.
Version of Clippy. It'll be Clippy, but for your sleep device. For your Morpheus sleep device. And I love... You know, occasionally you get flashes of Mark Gatiss's wit. He's an incredibly witty man. He wrote The League of Gentlemen. And, you know, it's a very funny gothic horror show. And he's a funny guy. And he doesn't get enough chance to show that in Doctor Who. And certainly not this episode. You can feel the comedy straining to get out of the, Blair Witch Project style design of this episode. And this is one moment where sort of, you know, the head, you think the head is done explaining everything about, you know, this data dump about the Morpheus device, and then she pops back up and says, terms and conditions apply.
Yeah.
In the middle of the Doctor and Clara's dialogue, and they turn to look at it. That's a lovely comedy moment. I would love to have seen more moments like that.
Yeah, they kind of, I think it's one of the last comedy moments in this particular episode, because I think it started off strong with the dialogue we mentioned earlier. That was a great moment. And I don't know, as we go along, there might be another, but yeah, it does get pretty serious and pretty even like a bit, I don't know, pompous even at a couple times. But
yeah. Well, speaking of pompous, the explanation gets a bit sort of, hits you over the head a bit with its sort of capitalism allegory here, which is that, you know, if you just sleep for a few minutes a night, or, you know, use the electrical signals from this device to make you pack in a whole night of sleep, then you'll get a jump on your competitor. You'll make more money. Time is money.
Yep. There's a lot of that.
First of all, no, time is time. Like, you know, the reason to use a machine like this, I think for a lot of people, would not be the sort of capitalistic instinct that Mark Gatiss is telling it is. You can imagine an artist who really wants to spend their life making as much art as possible. They would only
or a pair of podcasters who just want to do more podcasts of their favorite show over and over and over again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you
we
would do.
We want to watch all of Doctor Who, and you need to sleep no more for that.
I gotta say, they do this a few times in the Capaldi era, and it's like, I wish they just got it out of their system, because there was also, I believe, Oxygen the following year. which had obviously a very, very anti-capitalist move. And it's like, it's all well and good. It's just like, it's a little predictable and a little like, okay, I get it. You know, like,
yeah, and we didn't need it.
Yeah.
Like I'm as anti-capitalist as the next Bay Area resident, but we did not need this in this story. Thank you very much. I get what you're trying to say, but it's just sort of clunky.
And it works without it, to your point. You know, you don't really need that, and, you know, we don't have to hate corporations because they don't want to give a sleep. I think it's a very natural thing to, you know, for whatever your motivations, to, like, not want to sleep your life away.
And it sort of covers up this thing which we've seen in the background, that which the people that don't use this machine are called Rips. Right. Rip Van Winkle. It's like, oh, you're so sleepy, you actually sleep 8 hours a night, you're such a Rip. And this reminded me a lot of there's a 1992 science fiction novel by Nancy Kress called Beggars in Spain, which has this exact plot, which is that a whole new generation of kids grow up without, like, their DNA has been engineered to the point where they don't need to sleep, because sleep is a mystery in human behavior. We're still not entirely sure why we do it for the length of time that we do it. As they say in Sleep No More, we spend a third of our lives asleep. That's a huge sacrifice. A third of our lives. I mean, the motivation to eradicate that somehow is so strong. And it happens in Beggars in Spain. And there's a sort of a giant generational planetary split. And you really sort of get that big picture sense of what's happening with the, you know, the no sleep people are sort of treated like mutants in X-Men, you know.
Right.
There's that very human thing of we delineate and divide ourselves, and they start to get into this and Sleep No More, and they kind of pull away from it because there's too many confusing things going on at the same time. I wish they'd just focus on the, you know, the divide between the no sleepers and the Rips. Would have been fascinating to see more about that.
Yeah, exactly.
But it puts the Doctor in this interesting position of the Doctor is the one to defend sleep, which, as Clara points out, like, when do you sleep?
Yeah, I love that. He says, even I sleep. And she just does a when. Like, when you're not looking.
When you're not looking. And he has actually, in Deep Breath, at the beginning of his first season, Capaldi has this whole line about how he has micro sleeps or micro naps. Do you remember that?
Vaguely. I also just, exactly. Now that you pointed that out, that the only time I think we really see the Doctor sleep in the series is just after he's regenerated. Certainly when Tennant was sleep in, like, Rose's mom's apartment or whatever. And you know, it's really the only time we see him, like, really resting. If you look back at all the Doctors probably did it in their first
episode. He never uses that zero room anymore. I mean, you just
jettisoned,
my
friend. Jettisoned.
You can get another zero room, I'm sure.
You're probably sure you could. I mean, it's a big, the TARDIS is pretty big as we saw.
You've got many expansion slots in that thing.
Yeah.
He's not really the defender of sleep, right? You know, we know he's a hypocrite.
Yeah, 100%.
For saying all this, and yet he's doing this marvel. He's quoting Shakespeare like, whoa.
Well, he even says at one point, "Sleep is blessed." You know, this is where what I was thinking about when I said it gets a little pompous at times. You know, nice quote. And again, it's hard to trust the messenger.
It's great, great acting stuff. You know, knits the sleeve of raveled care, something like that. And he actually makes an excellent argument for why we sleep. Like, we do need to drop down into that dark well of pleasant dreams. You know, and that's an interesting point. But again, it's buried.
Yeah.
Because there's so much going on, and because it's the Doctor saying it, and he's not really the world's greatest sleep scientist, and also because something else is going on, because when the Doctor says, "I sleep when you're not looking," and he looks directly at Clara, and that is the first bit of found footage that we know is not coming from someone with a helmet.
Yeah, and it actually occurred to me that when he looks at her, you know, it's basically Capaldi turned to camera. And that never really happens. And it's like it's very interesting to sort of see Capaldi, like, turn to camera, because you see him in a way that you never see him at all in the rest of the series. And you really feel that intensity just from his stare.
Yeah. And it's unnerving, and it breaks the fourth wall. And I love the experimental nature of this episode. Mm-hmm. I love the Doctor Who is trying found footage, trying new things still at this late, 50 plus stage of its life. It could still be fresh in that sense of trying something new and experimental.
Did you when Capaldi?
I really wanted to like it.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of ambition here, certainly. But I remember when Capaldi turned to camera, there was a little bit of me. I got to say, I thought of like, is he going to say, "Oh, and please subscribe to the official Doctor Who YouTube channel." Like,
mash that subscribe button.
Yeah. That was just the most common thing I think I remember hearing Peter Capaldi say during that era, because if you went to anything on YouTube, you would get that end card, and there he was looking right at the camera asking you to subscribe.
That's funny. I don't remember that. That was,
well, they do it with all the doctors now. Capaldi might have been the first to actually officially do it, and now there's one with Whitaker, but
makes sense.
But anyway, they decide they see that the last pod is still occupied, and so they get it open, or I think it's actually the person inside opens it, and it turns out it's Rasmussen, our narrator.
Yep, and surprise.
He's there, and he's apparently the only survivor of the station because he hid himself in this sleep pod. And
this is where we find out what the monsters are, right? It sort of starts to slowly piece together from this point.
Right, exactly, because the doctor also analyzes some of the crumbling from the arm and finds out essentially it's mucus.
And it is mucus. They are mucus monsters.
They're dead blood cells, mucus, and dead skin. It's eye mucus.
And that was the point the first time watching it where I was like, I'm out. I just... mucus! A mucus monster!
Yeah.
Made up from sleep in your eye. I mean, it's like they kept saying sleep dust in your eye. I'm like, what kind of sleep are you getting in your eyes? Yeah, sometimes it's dusty and crusty. But for the most part, it's mucusy.
Yeah, it's not great, I gotta say. And I think you could, like, with a little more development, maybe. But it's really just like, what is it? It's this thing that's just gross. And, you're grossed out more than anything, right?
Yeah.
You're not terrified.
Exactly. It just it makes them dumb.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the worst sin for a Doctor Who monster, is to make them sort of irretrievably, irredeemably dumb and not scary. This is a comedy now.
Yeah, and again, like, it's very unclear, like, what eye mucus can do to a person, even in an agglomerated form, right? Like, I mean, all we saw is that the arm breaks when you close the door on it. Like, we have not seen why these things are really that terrifying. They make a noise.
Yeah.
They have a mouth. I haven't seen teeth. I haven't seen body
parts.
What are
they going to do?
Like, where is the
Eat
rest
you?
Of the crew anyway? I guess they've been dissolved, but, I mean, they don't really show that, and they're not explicit about that either, so like you're it's very vague, like, why we should be scared of these things other than this is a horror style episode.
Yeah, and they're just sort of lumbering and chase you while going raw. I think it's an interesting thing that the randomizer brought us here right after Dark Water, Death in Heaven, because this I think speaks to something that was going on throughout not just Moffat's tenure, but more Moffat's episodes, that he seemed to want to constantly one-up himself, and obviously Gatiss got in on the game as well, with sort of making things that kids are going to see in everyday life scary.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, what other thing can we turn into a scary monster? It starts with the Weeping Angels, and okay. it sort of continues.
Don't forget Shadows.
Shadows in the library. Count the Shadows, and those work great, and it sort of, but eventually it gets into this sort of sense of desperation, like, we've used up every idea, what can we make scary now? Let's make cremation scary. Whoops, too scary. That's making an adult scared, and just sort of making questions be asked of the BBC. And now they're like, well, what about sleep in your eye? Like,
yeah,
can...
it's really, I don't know. But Doctor Who, I mean, there's been so much. I mean, it's made plastic, any kind of plastic scary.
Yeah.
Wi-Fi,
which it
thinking
did well.
Of the modern era. There's more they can do. I applaud them for trying.
Yeah.
but it's this one not quite. Although,
yeah,
conceptually I agree with you, this isn't that scary. Again, it's developed, it could have been a little bit more scary, but I'm going to give the episode, again, points for pacing and not giving us too much time to think, because soon after this analysis has happened and we're trying to sort of figure out what to do, the monsters bust in, essentially. I think what happens is the gravity stabilizers, I forget, whatever they're called, are just suddenly turned off, and the doctor has to sort of fix that, which gives the monsters an opportunity to get in, and you're kind of like, it was another crisis. And they seemingly, like, kill Rasmussen, but it's, again, it's so unclear what they do. You're kind of like, what, did that just happen? Like, I'm not sure what happened. Yeah. Like, it's actually...
And that was another... That was another blink if you miss blink and you'll miss it moment, which I had, where I was like, wait, did I just fall asleep for a second there? They killed Rasmussen?
Yeah, which you kind of know they didn't because he's the narrator. Yeah. So you're just kind of ushered into the freezer, I think, after this, right? They sort of fix the grav thing somehow, and so the station is no longer in peril, but then they're all hiding in a freezer from the Sandman.
Yeah. And and it's sort of it's definitely zoning out on the plot by this point.
They're there, and I remember like Clara's the one who actually starts calling them the Sandman, and it's just a funny joke that the Doctor makes. It's like, oh, it's like the Silurians all over again, you know?
He may just be referencing the controversy over them being called Silurians. Is that?
Yeah, because it's the Silurians were. Couldn't be from the Silurian era, so it's kind of like, why are they called the Silurians? Well, ostensibly because the guy in the original Silurians episode got the period wrong, knew nothing clearly about Earth prehistory, and just called them that, and it stuck because it's, you know, it's actually one of the catchier names. You could, you know, it's better than what I believe they said later in the Sea Devils, that they should be called the Eocenes. Which doesn't sound as good, but also doesn't make much sense because that's after the dinosaurs. So then it becomes this controversy. So which is it? You know, why aren't they the Cretaceouses or the Jurassics? Which both of those sound silly. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is Gattis once again flexing his Doctor Who nerd muscles, in a not particularly relevant way. But,
yeah.
But it does make for a nice scene of like. You know, yeah, okay, we'll call them the Sandman. But the Doctor is like, yeah, okay, Clara's right. And this does the only way in which this episode ties into the wider season 9 is the fact that Clara is overconfident in everything throughout this.
Right, right. Which actually, Moffat made that a requirement for when Gattis wrote it. He, you know, the original version, I think he went a little more traditional companion, that she was a little worried or sweating this out, and then. She's the one who's overconfident, who says, like,
right.
I don't need to hold your hand, Doctor. He's like, yeah, but I do. Like, I'm scared.
Which is unfortunate, because this is a moment where you could have done with some companion terror to make these monsters a little scarier by proxy, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. But in any case, there's the twist. They reveal the twist around this point that the Doctor's put it together that there aren't cameras for this footage, that this footage is actually being... seen, recorded by sleep itself, like it's in the dust. Now, honestly, like you bailed out at the eye booger monsters themselves, and I'm sympathetic to that. It actually wasn't where I checked out. This is where I was like, wait a minute, like I it wasn't so much I was checked out or decided that sucked. I was just, I spent so much time thinking, like, how would that even work? You know, that I was sort of now for the rest of the episode on a weird metaphysical level, like trying to think about the concept more than actually being part of the action, and that I started to sort of lose it a bit.
It's a clever twist too far. It's one twist too many. Very characteristic of the Moffat era. You know, pack too many twists into, you know, a 10-minute space of time, and you're left just sort of thinking, as you say, how would this work? Over and over again. Wait, how does it work? And the thing that stopped me around here was this notion that that they sort of hint at, which is that the sleep in our eye, sleep boogers are actually like really monsters all along, and we're suppressing them by sleeping.
Yeah.
So we're carrying this life form around with us, which is interesting. And maybe that would have worked more, but you've got to flesh that out. You've got to make that explicit.
Yeah, I know. He really just sort of like puts in some sort of paper explanation for this and just says, go with it. And to be fair, I kind of mostly went with it. So even the second time around. So, I mean, I know these things sort of still sort of bother me. But again, they didn't bother me as much the first time. And this time, like, you know, like there's enough funny dialogue. There's enough there's enough moments and enough scares and enough sort of clever use of horror movie imagery and tropes and turning some of them on their head that I still was, you know, this is pretty good. So what happens is they, you know, you almost forget about the plot at this point. Like they evade the creatures because the doctor realizes they're blind, which I finally realized, and I believe this is the point. So correct me if you didn't get this, but I mean, the reason they're blind is because Rasmussen is hijacking the footage. That's what it is. So that he's creating his thing. So he's creating his video. And so because he's manipulating that, the footage isn't actually going to the creatures anymore. You know, they can't actually see anything. They're just kind of lumbering around, killing whatever they can. So I think that's kind of what that was supposed to be. I didn't quite get that the first time. But I was like, oh, because I was like, why would they be blind if, you know, the video footage is in the dust? Well, it's because it's constantly being, like, hijacked by Rasmussen.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. I wish the show had given me that. It's funny, I just read Vulture did an excellent oral history of the final episode of Lost.
Oh, nice.
I don't know if you've seen that. Checking out. And there's long oral history, and then the comment section is almost as interesting because it's people sort of looking back on how disappointing the final episode of Lost was all these many years later and why it didn't land with so many people. And there was definitely that vibe of, if you're having to explain it 10 years later, you know, if you're still having to explain that, no, they weren't dead the whole time, maybe there's a flaw in your plot.
Yeah, agreed. yeah, it's an issue.
The fact that you're having to explain to me bits of Mark Astor's intention here, I think sort of speak to the same thing. I'm like, if it's that confusing, like, what? Why couldn't he have just sort of tried to explain this to three or four people and have them get it or not get it and then adjust the script accordingly?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe he was working too much on Sherlock at the time and this was just something he was tossing off. But
yeah, deadlines,
man. Didn't seem like it was best polished.
No, it certainly wasn't.
Which is ironic because what we find out at the end... we might as well just sort of skip ahead to the end at this point, I think, because it is kind of the only genuinely scary for me bit of the whole monsters reveal that Rasmussen is the monster himself, and he pulls out his eye and he dissolves into sand, and surprise, he's won. Again, this is something Gattis was going for, right? But that didn't really make explicit this idea that sometimes the Doctor loses and and that has happened here. And it's happened here because his whole goal was to just craft a compelling story using this footage and send it out to the entire solar system so that everyone, I guess, will have sleep monsters in their eyes now and they'll all be activated by this electronic signal.
Right.
And humanity's time is over and that's the idea. But this is... So it's a really ballsy thing to say... I'm a genius who has crafted a story specifically to make you watch.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And this whole... It's very fourth wall-y. It's very the story looking at itself and bragging about itself and being very meta. But if you're going to do that, you've really got to have a good story.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't deliver. And he's there bragging at the end about how he made it a good story. To make you, you know, in a big monster at the end.
Yeah,
to
I
make
mean, it he had a good story structure. And, like, you know, if you're looking at Rasmussen, this is his submission to, you know, space film school. you know, dude, I'm going to give you a pass. This is, you know, you've got a promising structure
don't
call here.
Us.
You need to flesh some things out for this to really work.
But you've got the
formula. You've got the right scares. There's a lot of witty dialogue. Great performance by your lead. You know, this is a B. This is a B, my friend. You got to really run with the pros, though. You're gonna have to step it up a little bit. So that's kind of where I came away with it. So it's like,
It's funny. It's someone tweeted this week about how their job as an editor and their job as a parent of toddlers was one and the same thing. They found themselves saying the same things,
right?
And one of them is like, well, this has a lot of potential. What you're doing has a lot of potential. Sticking crowns, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. You know, let's work with this. Let's workshop this
before you proceed to redline the entire thing.
exactly.
Yeah. In this case, I wouldn't redline the entire thing. I mean, I think big parts of it need to be changed. Big parts of it need to be explained. But overall, like, to me, this final bit almost brings it home, right? Like, it salvages it. It saves it, like, in my mind. And I didn't mind watching it again. I actually wouldn't mind watching it again. I feel like it's an affecting episode that evokes certain feelings. There are great lines in it. And I got some vibes like that a little bit from the some Thing vibes. So, you know, because there's these booger monsters and you're never really told they can or can't, you know, take the shape of actual people, which clearly it did. And if they had sort of made that a little more explicit early on, I'm imagining like a more, a different episode structure, but like the idea that these things aren't just monsters, but they can impersonate you, you know, that's like, it comes out at the end, but you're like, oh, wow, well, that's cool. And you could really do something more like along the lines of Among Us if you were to do this again, right? And I know Mark Gatiss has said, like, he has imagined a sequel to this, was even intending to do it, but it ended up doing his Ice Warrior episode instead the following season.
Oh, interesting.
But since we pretty much know life, the Earth civilization didn't end after the 38th century in the Doctor Who universe, you know, There's opportunity for Mark or some other writer to write that sequel, but I would love to see a sequel that is but you could essentially write off all the things that make no sense in this episode as like, yeah, Rasmussen was lying or he just doctored the footage, and you could make better explanations and have it you know, do a sort of slightly different horror movie formula, and boom, you've got something.
Yeah. Great potential, and I think, you know, I'm always down for watching stories that don't quite work, because, you know, Stephen King always says you learn more about writing from reading a bad story than from reading a good one, because you get to see what they did wrong. And, you know, I think that this is sort of, this could be a good example for film school, or, you know, any writing class, of like what not to do in a lot of ways.
Right.
You know, don't be too clever. Don't pack too many things in. Make your characters discernible and give them traits that you'll actually care about and remember.
Once you having a good structure, good performances, it's not enough, right? And this is my general note to Moffat too. You need to earn those beats, and suspension of disbelief does have a breaking point.
And there's a thing we haven't even mentioned, which is the guy in the party who's sort of anxious and hates grunts and is constantly bothered by the grunt, ends up having this, you know, beautiful scene with the grunt at the end, and it just sort of totally unearned.
Right.
You can see what he was going for.
But, like, you know, to your point, you don't really care about these people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. A lot of wasted opportunities, a lot of coming close. And ultimately should have been much more memorable than it was, given all the notable firsts this thing has.
But it does for me. I mean, I was glad to watch it again for the sort of personal reason of thinking about the nature of sleep, because I've got to say that I would totally step into that machine.
Huh.
I hate the fact that I have to sleep for a third of the day.
I think most people would. I like what the doctor said, and I'm sympathetic to it. And I also think there's sort of a greater point of, if you're ever really into a project and you really, to really go forward with that project, you're so into it, you've been working on it for so long, you really need to step away from it for a little while. And using that as sort of like an, looking at life as a project, you know, that you're always working on. You know, this is sort of what my, in my head, what sort of the justification for sleep is. You need to step away from it for a little while, pretty regularly, and to reboot.
But the doctor makes a great argument for sleep, and it, sort of in the context of watching the wider show, where you're aware that the doctor never really sleeps, you're thinking, what a hypocrite. But watching this out of order, I think increases the sense that you, like, I got more of that message this time around. That was the one thing that was better for me on a second viewing was, yeah, okay, I get the reasons for sleep now. Like, I'm more at peace with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to bed happily after this episode, instead of grudgingly as I usually do.
Did you like Capaldi's line at the end? Because I think it probably would really resonate with you when he says, none of this makes any sense.
Just doesn't, it reminds me of the one meme that's coming out of Knives Out, the movie, which is a great movie if you haven't seen it, and is all over Twitter, is two side-by-side shots of Daniel Craig in that movie saying the line, just doesn't make any damn sense. Compels me, though. And that's kind of exactly what's going on with this episode, that it doesn't make any damn sense for us, but it is kind of compelling.
Well, to give our summary judgment here, it sounds like you're probably just over on the first side of that meme, and I'm probably over on the second side. So, like, I would say this is barely a Dalek in terms of our Dalek Ogron rating system. For me, I have issues with it, but ultimately, like, I'm glad I saw it again.
I will certainly rate the monster an Ogron. I think maybe that's where I'll apply that rating to. But yeah, if we're thinking about stream it or skip it, I say skip it, unless you have a problem with insomnia, in which case it might be interesting to you.
Well, the funny thing is about this episode, we can almost skip over our other thing we like to do, which is that what if the evil plot had succeeded, because the evil plot did succeed. Yes. and
that's the thing, we don't really get to see the full implications of that. So what, all of humanity is sleep monsters in the 38th century now?
It's possible.
And would the doctor not notice this at some point?
Well, I definitely want to see the sequel. I mean, that's the thing, right? Like, there's this bit where it's intriguing enough, just as an idea that the doctor loses, that, you know, you kind of want to see what happens. It's the episode isn't so bad that you just hope they never revisit it. It's not another Valyard. But the Mark Gatiss even said, I remember at his, I believe it was at the viewing that I saw, like, you know, when we asked him, because we were all kind of a little dumbfounded at the end, and someone asked, like, did I get that right? Did the doctor just lose? He said, oh, yes. You know, and they asked him sort of, why did you want to write an episode that does that? And he mentioned growing up with Doctor Who and seeing Earthshock as a kid.
Yes, and there's the next Peter Davison connection.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, the Doctor kind of wins in that episode. Obviously, he defeats the Cybermen, but, I mean, he loses Adric. And that clearly had an impact for him. And that really resonated with me, too, which might have led to my liking the episode even more. Because, yeah, like, I had the exact same experience growing up, watching Earthshock. Like, whoa, did that just happen?
But it's ironic because, of course, we're going in to face the Raven, the next episode, which is the second example of a companion dying, or apparently dying, in Doctor Who. And when I wrote my review of Face the Raven, which I absolutely loved, I was like, this is... I hearkened back to Earthshock. I was like, this is only really the second example. And, of course, I should have known Moffat was going to hit the reset button on that, and Clara didn't actually die, and whatever. But in the moment, it had an amazing impact. And... Earthshock was on my mind. But it's interesting because you get, at the end of watching these things, you know, you get the next time on, because they do that in season 9, you get a little taste of Face the Raven, a little trailer for Face the Raven. And just that trailer was more compelling as a story than anything in Sleep No More. And it was almost sort of embarrassing for it to be put in its place by a truly great Doctor Who story that's coming next.
Yeah, there's a lot in that one.
Anyway,
so
speaking of coming next,
yes,
shall we Shall we fire up the randomizer?
Let's all right, activate. Let me you have the technology.
Press some buttons and pull some levers here and
let's find out where we're going.
See what we can come up with. I'm trying to get my sound effect going, but it really doesn't want to here. Anyway, all right, we have random.org. We are using atmospheric randomness, atmospheric noise, to figure out where we're going next. We have the full list of 298 stories that the show has told us. I have numbers between 2 and 298 plugged in, and I'm going to hit the generate button.
Let's do it.
All right. 82.
Ooh, 82. We're going. Oh, all right. Classic.
We're going.
Let's see.
Early.
We are at
Pyramids of Mars.
Pyramids of Mars. Nice.
Nice. Okay. Now, this is actually, you know, like often spoken of as a classic Tom Baker story.
Very much.
With Sarah Jane Smith. And it's one that's often referred to when people talk about the Doctor talking about himself and his life and his history. And it's got some good quotes in there.
Well, yeah, for sure. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I do know this is a very much, it's a talked about episode a lot because it actually has things to say about, wait for it, time travel. That is all I'll say at this point. But I'm really interested because, you know, for a show that is about time travel, Doctor Who is wildly, I wouldn't say, maybe wildly inconsistent is harsh, but it rarely comes in and tells you what the rules are. And that's obviously for a reason. You know, it wants to keep those flexible. But this is one of those rare episodes where it has something to say about them. So that's going to be fun to see. And there's a lot of other stuff going on. I mean, you know.
I'm excited about it. Baker's my favorite Doctor, so I'm glad we're finally going there.
Yeah.
We're getting out of the zone of Doctor's Name Peter.
Well, maybe we'll get into the Doctor's Name Baker.
Yeah, oh no, don't take us to Colin next.
Yeah, well, we're going to get there someday, so we'll
we will have to do it. I love that. We will have to do every story eventually.
All right, well, this has been great, Chris, revisiting Sleep No More with you. Again.
Sleep No More, No More.
Yeah. So thank you, everyone, for listening to our fine podcast. By the way, we're a podcast. If you have not yet subscribed to us, please do. We're on Apple, we're on Spotify, Breaker, yes. All the places you find your great, great podcasts. So please
leave us a review.
Leaving us a review would be great. We're not going to tell you what kind of review to leave. We're happy to if you stop and say anything, but you know, we do have a special place in our heart for those 5-star reviews.
Yeah, but if this episode was a C-, that's fine. Let us know. Let us know what we can do better.
Absolutely.
And
follow us on the socials. Yep, we're on Twitter and Instagram at pull2open63, and we're on TikTok, putting out the vids, the excerpts from our fine podcast here at pull2open.
Nope. Yeah, huh? The kids love us on TikTok.
Apparently. But yeah, follow us there, leave us a comment, and follow the podcast, and we'll see you next time.